Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Good evening, everyone. This is Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. And we are going very excited tonight to have Kirk McKenzie back as our co-host again this week. And hopefully Red Beckman has got a live mic with us tonight as well. Our first guest, Bob Sherman, is already on line with us. And we should have Dr. Charles Kay and Keith Kabista joining us. And we want to open the show, as we always do, with a prayer. Please pray with me. Almighty Father God, we just come before you humbly, acknowledging you as our one and only true God, and we're just so blessed to be able to get on the internet tonight and to share our ideas with people, and especially to seek solutions for our country. And we ask that you bless this country. We ask that your spirit be with us tonight, go before us in everything we say and do. We pray, Father, that our message tonight will be heard and that it will glorify you. And we're just especially thankful to be able to be reconciled with you through your Son, Yeshua. And it's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, Kurt, it's been a great week. It's been a crazy week, hasn't it?
It has been.
It's been an awful lot of activity, especially with what's going on with the first caucus in Iowa and everything. And I know that this show tonight, I certainly hope Red is on with us, because Red's been talking about the wolves for a long, long time now, practically all of 2011. He was the one that really brought this topic out to me and many others. And he's very excited to have the people that you've lined up tonight. Because it's near and dear to his heart, and he sees this as just one of those local issues that can be used to bring out the bigger picture of what the government is doing and how they're overreaching and how they are controlling so many things and trying to press the people down and upset the pecking order that was established by our founders. And so I'm gonna be quiet, and I'm just gonna turn the floor over to you, Kirk, and let you introduce Bob, and hopefully the others will be joining us.
Well, Terry, thank you so much again for the support to continue this series on Defend Rural America. The as I engage in this story, and the listeners who are dialing in now, hopefully week by week listening as we continue to peel back the stories about the threats to a good chunk of our nation. One of the stories that I was interested in exploring was wolves. I knew they were released, but I really haven't been involved in the details like Red has been. And so Red, you know, has led the parade here. I got on board recently, but it turns out to be very timely, because we now have a wolf that's crossed over into California, the famous or infamous, depending on your viewpoint, OR7. Kind of sounds like C-3PO. But not quite so friendly. So we have wolves that have been released in Yellowstone, 60 of them, I guess, back in 1995 and 1996, without any, with lots of game and prey there, and not too many predators to get. They are growing and expanding rapidly across the western states, and so I think it is a very timely topic. And one of the first people I met and talked to was Bob Sherman. And Bob, I'd like to have you on, and you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then you were really responsible for bringing in the other guests, so perhaps you can introduce yourself and the other guests as well.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Sure can. No problem.
Okay. Well, my name is Bob Sherman. I live in Corvallis, Montana, in the Bitterroot Valley. And I became involved in the wolf issue. When Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks announced that they were doing a study to determine the cause of a dramatic downturn we had in our elk population. And when they announced that, I got the idea that, it would be good to do a documentary film on that study. And I teamed up with a local filmmaker, and that first documentary, the idea that to do a film on the Bitterroot Elk study, kind of quickly turned into a little bit more, and it actually turned into a second film, and primarily because of all the misinformation that we were running into in doing our research. And during the filming, I've interviewed literally dozens of wolf experts, politicians, and traveled literally thousands of miles. And the main lesson I think that I gathered and learned through this whole process was that, this isn't really about wolves. Many people, it's about wolves, but for these multi-million-dollar associations that are, advocating for the wolves, it's really about money and about control over land use. And, they want to run the show out here in rural America. And, listen, wolves met mutually agreed upon recovery goals on December 31st. Of 2001, but litigation by these multi-million-dollar organizations have kept them under federal protection until just this year. And I mean, the reason was simply it's not in their financial interest to have these animals removed from federal protection. But I don't know if the people are on, but
they are, Bob. Everyone, okay. Everyone is on.
All right, I'm joined by Dr. Charles Kay. Dr. Kay is an adjunct professor of political science and a senior research scientist with the Institute of Political Economy at Utah State University. He holds degrees in wildlife ecology, environmental studies, and wildlife biology. And I'll tell you, there's not a person on this planet that's been more accurate in predicting the outcome and consequences of wolfery introduction. And welcome, Dr. Kay. Are you there?
Dr. Charles Kay, are you there?
Doesn't sound like it yet, Bob. Why don't you go ahead and continue with our next guest?
All right, then the next guest, Keith Kubista. Keith's a good friend of mine. He's here in the Bitterroot as well. He lives in Stevensville, Montana. And he's president of the Montana Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. And I'll tell you, I've never met a person that's more dedicated to conservation, wildlife conservation, than Keith. I mean, this guy's a tireless worker. And I want to thank you for participating tonight, Keith. I know it was hard to squeeze it in.
Well, it's my pleasure, Bob. As you indicate, the sun doesn't set, and it certainly doesn't rise without my full effort on trying to gain back some of the losses we've experienced here, not only in the Bitterroot in Montana, but throughout the country with regard to how so many of the groups that you mentioned, the radical environmentalists among the top, but also many well-experienced NGOs that have utilized our taxpayer dollars to release predator populations, primarily wolves, as a biological weapon to impose their agenda and end our hunting, ranching, and Western way of life. Our organization, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, who has state chapters also in Utah, Alaska, Idaho, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Colorado, use much of our efforts and funds to protect the state's sovereign right to hunt, fish, and trap on our public lands, as well as to protect our sheep and cattle and domestic pets from predation. Those are some of our goals. We also encourage implementation and techniques to control these predator populations so that we can meet and continue with our objectives of hunting and ranching opportunities. And we do support the state and local management of all wildlife. Unfortunately, it's been trampled with regard to the local control. And as Bob mentioned right here in the Bitterroot, which used to be a very significant and one of the premier elk hunting areas within the entire country, is no longer the case. And in our valley of Valley County, for example, we used to have an $11 million, just in this small community of less than 40,000 people area-wide, of over $11 million of hunting industry, which included not only the hunting and the families of employees that serve with the hunters and guides and outfitters and taxidermists, but also the secondary businesses that were reliant on so much of this resident and non-resident hunting. We're now seeing that that area of $11 million has been reduced by more than 50 to 80%, primarily due to wolf predation.
Okay, and then, Bob, you want to introduce the final guest here? Bob, are you on there?
I am. I'm sorry. I had it on mute and I forgot.
Let's go ahead and introduce Steve, and then what we can do once we understand, you know, we have everybody that's been introduced, then we can go through a methodical way of addressing all the discussion that we like to have here.
Okay. I also asked Steve Alder to join us. Steve is one of the founders of Idaho for Wildlife. He's another tireless worker in wildlife conservation, and I know that he dedicates most all of his free time to advocating for Idaho's wildlife. And thanks for joining us, Steve.
It's good to be with you. We're fairly new. Started in 08, and our mission is just to dedicate the preservation of Idaho's wildlife, and that means all wildlife. The I think the biggest thing that got us started was Dr. K, who's, I don't know if he's on board yet, but I found an article in 1993, Peterson's Hunting Magazine, where he wrote predicting this day would come. I mean, we call him the Wolf Prophet because he saw that we would go through the delisting and the relisting and how the environs would move in and use the ESC against us. So we're very much against holding our state fish and game agency accountable. And we find that one of the biggest things our group does is expose the fraud in the science and exploit their agendas and hold them accountable. And we've got 300 years of scientific data in Canada where the same wolf came from. Why are we not using, if that's the same wolf, why are we not following the same data and model that Canadians are? So I don't know where, you know, I hope Dr. K comes on board because he'd really be an asset tonight if we can hear from him.
Okay, well, I don't think he's on board quite yet, so what we probably ought to do, Bob, is perhaps we can lay this down in kind of a logical fashion, and you can kind of determine what sequence you think would be best to proceed, but we need to probably address a little bit, talk about the history, you know, what happened, how this came about, some of the discussion perhaps that was going on in that period of time. We can address the science that, quote, unquote, science that was behind this, and the other, both sides, I guess, of that. We ought to talk about then what really has happened since the wolf reintroduction and get into some specifics in terms of, you know, how many there are, how far they've reached, et cetera, et cetera, and probably some personal stories about some of the problems that have occurred, and then perhaps we can talk about solutions. So in whatever sequence you want to address that, but those would be some areas I think we should talk about tonight.
Okay. Well, I'll just speak real briefly on some of my knowledge, and then I'll defer to Keith and Steve. But the wolves that I believe were added to the endangered species list upon passing or shortly thereafter of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, and they came out with
a plan for reintroduction in, I believe, 1987. And it was agreed upon by several different groups, including ranchers and hunters and some of the wolf advocacy groups. And, you know, part of that was that, you know, there were certain numbers that were set down to where once the wolves met these numbers, that they would be brought out from under federal protection and placed under state management. And they were, you know, they released some wolves in Yellowstone, and then I believe there were two releases in Idaho around around Salmon area. And that was 1995 was the main release, and then they released a few more in 96. Excuse me. And by December 31st, 2001, the wolves had met the delisting requirements, which did include a certain number of breeding pairs for a period of a couple of years, and you know, they had met that, and then the court cases started. And you know, the environmental groups that originally agreed to these numbers to you know, to bring them under state management, you know, didn't live up to their word, and that's not surprising, quite honestly. You know, in interviewing Governor Otter, that was one thing that he brought up very emphatically, is, you know, when people give you their word, you know, we expect them to live by it. And you know, unfortunately, that didn't happen. A gentleman by the name of Hank Fisher was with Defenders of Wildlife at the time. Now he's with the National Wildlife Federation, last I knew. He came up with a plan to get a buy-in from the Stock Growers Association, which basically was a fund that Defenders of Wildlife put up to reimburse ranchers for you know, for livestock losses. And that really turned into a complete fallacy. Number one is that the people that they had out there, you know, determining whether it was, you know, a depredation by wolves, you know, it just, you know, it just came down to nothing was ever killed by wolves. You couldn't prove that anything was killed by wolves. And the other thing is that Defenders, you know, basically canceled that program almost immediately. You know, they put the program in place to get the buy-in, and then they you know, pulled the rug out from under. Again, not surprising. And you know, now livestock, I believe I know it comes from a fund from I believe from the state. And I could be mistaken, but I know Keith and Steve would know. But I believe that taxpayers pay for the depredation now, if you can prove that your animal was killed by a wolf. But so, you know, we've essentially since January of 2002, let's say, you know, we've had wolves growing, the wolf population growing. Without any management whatsoever, and you know, many areas we've seen, you know, a terrible effect on our elk populations, our moose populations, and you know, with livestock, we had a number of incidents this spring in the Bitterroot, and those are just going to continue to grow. I mean, those problems are just going to continue. You know, as wolves become more and more overpopulated, we're going to see more, you know, dogs and cats and horses and cows and, you know, whatever, you know, killed by wolves. And, you know, eventually, unfortunately, we're probably going to see, you know, some people attacked and killed by wolves. But I'll shut up now and let, you know, Keith or Steve, if you want to expand on that.
Well, perhaps let me just jump in with a question that perhaps then Keith or Steve, you can address when you make your comments about this as well, particularly about the history. I understand it was 68 wolves that were released, and the argument was basically that they needed them in Yellowstone Park to thin out the growing caribou herd or something like that, but the target was just Yellowstone National Park. Is that true?
Central Idaho was included also.
Right.
And Central Idaho, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
That was for the elk.
Okay, for the elk, okay.
Yeah,
well,
I think this is I think one of the great myths that have been perpetrated is they had alternatives to doing this, and the alternatives were not considered either viable or were overlooked. And so their whole purpose in introducing these wolves, which was done in Yellowstone initially, and as Steve points out, in some of the central Idaho and SOA areas, was for some grandiose ecological scheme, and that's where I wish that Dr. K were here, because he could nail this like no one could. But
he'll be calling in right now, by the way, just to let you know. He should be on here within a minute or two.
Great, and he can probably expand on that a good bit more from that historical perspective and some of the intrusions. But I did want to get to one point, and my good friend Jim Beers, who I think most of the folks know that has a history in this, who used to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there was a fund that was used, the Pittman-Robertson money that the states gather and the feds gather from the sale of hunters' articles, bullets, hooks, belts, etc. And they took this $45 to $60 million from these state fish and wildlife agencies and used it to introduce these wolves with no accountability, and have not yet reimbursed, as far as we can tell, those state agencies and other sources of that income.
How much money again?
$45 to $60 million was the number that Jim Beers quotes from those days back in the...
45 to 60 million, and it was 68 wolves, correct?
For the 68 wolves.
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, this is Dr. K.
Yeah, if I understand, I'm sorry I'm late. The Batman watch must be dying. My watch was off by about an hour. But someone called
on
me.
The
so
show.
Not all that money went to that, okay? Not to wolves. They did a bunch of other stuff with it. They opened, if I remember Jim Beers' stuff correctly, they also opened an office in California, and I think put the Alaska senator's daughter in charge of it or something like that. And so they did other things with that money, too, that they weren't authorized to do, but it did go for the wolf stuff, okay?
But that was the amount, Dr.
Yeah,
K, correct?
That was the total. That was the total amount, somewhere between 45 and 60, because
right.
When he was trying to figure all this out, this is, if you know his story, is they basically... how do I want to put this? They were trying to fire him then, so they had this agreement, and he retired then, okay? So there never was
a chance that Jim Beers is listening in here. I don't know if we can, I talked to him a little bit ago, and he was going to listen in. I don't know if we can get him on the horn, but.
Hey, Bob, this is Steve. Are you on a speakerphone or anything? You're not coming through too good. Might be through your computer. I don't know if you can improve. It's hard to hear you.
Yeah, there was a...
Turn the volume up.
Okay.
Is that any better?
A little bit. It's getting some echo, but it sounds like it's coming through an internet connection via a real phone. So we can hear you.
Okay.
And this is Keith again. I'd just like to interject one other thing. At the time this whole introduction affair was going on, and I use the word introduction rather than reintroduction, the promise to pay for this wolf depredation was a rather deceptive strategy, as Bob points out, because what occurred is they created what we now have, which is an unfunded mandate that our livestock producers are paying the bill for the loss of their livestock. Our hunters are paying the bill for the lack of hunter opportunity that's going on, and the very people that wanted these wolves have no accountability or payment into the negative creation of the situation that they have caused.
Well, that was the plan from the beginning.
Yeah,
that was their plan from the beginning. Okay.
And they promised this revenue from, you know, from all the people that were going to come out to watch Wolves and stuff. And it's like, you know, there's been nobody. You talk to outfitters that have even tried to go with that business model to, you know, to come out and view the Wolves or whatever. And, you know, not a single person in the world has come to look at the Wolves.
Well, and even
let me
more,
just jump in for a quick second to let you know that Jim Beers has joined the conversation, so you can invite him in whenever you want.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you have to remember the stuff. Oops. When Defenders set all this up, I mean, this was a voluntary stuff. I mean, they didn't sign any contracts and stuff, so you can't hold them accountable. It was a masterful PR stroke on their particular thing. On it, you know, and they were only going to pay for, I don't know if you've gotten to the verified part of this stuff on it. I mean, you know, they're only paying for verified kills. Well, the thing is, a lot of the things that the Wolves kill, you know, you can't, there's a certain thing you have to go through to verify it, and a lot of the kills are never verified. I mean, if there's a whole pack of Wolves, whatever, and they kill a calf, and all there is after an hour or two is a blood smear on the ground, there's no way, according to the way the government regulations are set up to verify it, that you can verify that as a Wolf kill.
So for a rancher to get reimbursed for a kill, they actually have to go through a process, and that process includes somebody coming out and doing an inspection?
That's right. That was the case under the Defenders thing when the Defenders was doing it, and it's under the case on all the state compensation programs that have come since on it like that. Okay. And if just the fact your livestock goes missing and you find a bunch of bones and wolf tracks around it, that's not evidence of it. Okay. I mean, basically what wolves do, because they have 1,000 pounds per square inch in their jaws when they bite the teeth, okay? And so what they do is, even though they might not rip the skin and they attack the animals from the back, they're not really trying to hamstring them, but they go for the back because it's the least dangerous part of the animal to attack on it, and they just clamp on their jaws and do all this basically tissue damage. So how you have to verify a kill is you have to find the kill when it's really fresh, and they tell you to put a tarp over it until the federal guys get there, which may be a day or two. And then when they skin it out, even though the skin's not broken, you can see this massive tissue damage, just like someone took a hammer to their back end and just pounded it, where it's all bloodshot meat and stuff on it. Because wolves kill differently than lions do. And, in fact, some ex-Wildlife Service person has published a whole book on how you can tell lion kills from bear kills, from wolf kills, from coyote kills. If you have enough of the animal left to be able to, you know, do what I was just explaining, where you have to be able to skin it out and look for the teeth marks in different places and stuff.
And let me ask you something. I'm kind of curious on this predation aspect of it. You know, wolves seem to me to be, if not the ultimate predator, they certainly seem to be near the top, because they hunt in packs and come at from all angles. If they go after a cow or a calf, I mean, what's the, are they 100% effective, or do they?
Well, no one has any data as far as wolf attacks on livestock, you know, what percent succeed and stuff on it. And there's some data for some other animals, primarily moose, because of the Isle Royale situation. Isle Royale is a weird, unique thing that really has no bearing on anything in the rest of the world. But what it is, I mean, like when wolves test moose, because moose are so large and they've actually killed wolves on it, it's the moose that stand and hold their ground that the wolves just leave alone. The moose that run are the ones that die. And so in that case, from the data from Isle Royale, like only 1 in 10 testing, you know, is successful where they kill the prey. In most cases, there isn't any data on this. There's no data, you know, as far as, well, there may be a little data on an elk out of Yellowstone, but there's no data when they do this on mule deer, and there's no data when they do it on the livestock.
Well, I think one piece of data that is rather accurate is, according to much of the livestock industry, due to these strict evidentiary standards which must be met in order for the payment to get made for the loss of the livestock, those numbers are in the range of 1 in 7 depredations are compensated. That's an average that we've heard repeatedly throughout the West, where the wolves have the highest density of livestock predation.
Gotcha. Now let me, as part of this thing, is describing the problem. So going back here, 68 wolves get released in Yellowstone, maybe some more get released, I don't know, in Idaho. But what is the scope of the problem today in terms of estimates of the numbers of wolves and the range over which they now spread?
And Jim can probably answer that better than any of us. He's the biggest expert, but there is no limit on the range that they can spread. I think that's probably the place to start.
Right.
But how far have they reached at this point?
One of the things you have to understand as far as this experimental reinduction that was done, it's called the 10J rule, experimental non-essential population, okay? Once those wolves leave that three-state area, okay, like they have now, and they've gotten into Washington, and they've gotten to Oregon, and I just read a report they found one in California now, okay? Once they leave that three-state experimental area, it's under full ESA protection, okay? So you have to understand that.
These wolves got back up into Canada as well. I guess they came from Canada originally, and then they've gone back, grown back into Canada. So it's now over multiple states, six or seven states at least at this point in time?
Five, sure.
Well, they're in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon, California as a minimum.
Yeah, and there's accounts of wolves getting into North Dakota too, but they may be coming out of Minnesota. It's hard to say. And, of course, some of the wolves from Yellowstone, one was killed in Colorado on this thing. So they, because they dispersed so widely and they have the potential. As far as numbers, I haven't seen the latest thing this year, but as far as last year, the federal government was owning up to like 1,600 total wolves, the way they count them, okay? But the problem is the way they count them, that's not the actual number of wolves. And you have to go to the first delisting lawsuit in Malloy's court and go to the declarations of David Meach, okay? Who we all know has worked on wolves longer than almost anybody else here in the States and works for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Basically, he said you can double whatever the official number is, you double it.
This is Steve. We just got a report tonight that half of the wolves killed in Idaho came from areas that Idaho Fish and Game said didn't even have wolves. So does that help with your...
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to understand... I don't know if you listen, because I got in here late. I just filed this for an academic interest, okay, on it like this. And because I'm interested in the predation stuff, I'm not involved in this thing and the politics of it or anything else like that kind of stuff. So what I'm citing you to is stuff that I could prove where someone said it, that I have a hard copy of it. I mean, of course.
Well, Dave, you mentioned Dr. Meach, Dave Meach. In my interview with him, he specifically said that 1,650 number that you brought up, Dr. K, was really one of his pet peeves, and he really didn't like that the media constantly put that out there, because he said the media is full well aware that that is not the number of wolves, and he specifically said that in his estimation there were 4,000 to 5,000 wolves, and this was almost 2 years ago. He thought that there would be 4,000 to 5,000 wolves in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho.
Yeah, well, that would not surprise me. And if you have that on tape, that's one thing, okay? Do you have it on tape?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's, all I'm going by is what he said, because a declaration is an official certified, so you're swearing to it in court when they submit that stuff. And that's what he said in the second delisting lawsuit. Because you have to understand the way they count them. This is a long, complicated thing, too. But they only count packs that have pups in the fall, okay, where they have living pups in the fall. They don't count lone wolves or single wolves on it. And then, of course, as the wolf numbers increase on it, and the budgets fall or stay the same, you got more places to look for more wolves. The state and or the feds just don't have the time and the money. And if you don't think about how you count wildlife, estimate wildlife populations, I mean, it would not surprise me that if David Meach said it, I'm willing to agree on that point with David Meach.
Now, just to kind of wrap up this particular point in terms of this expansion, so probably one of the best presentations I've seen, if people go to the Defend Rural America website and click on the tab Wolves, in there are some photographs of some of these wolves that have been now caught or shot in Idaho with the new tags there. But there's also a video that was done by Big Game Forever, and it actually visualizes for you just how far the expansion, it actually maps them onto the western states and shows you kind of how this is growing. So it's a very visual presentation of this. It is a big problem.
Yeah, there's because of how it was done and everything, there's basically no way to stop them, because once it got outside of those three areas, it's full ESA protection. on the stuff on it. And because of the criminal penalties involved, which is a felony if you get caught killing one of them, I mean, personally, my personal opinion is you'd have to be crazy to shoot one. But
I probably should have had somebody from California here online to kind of tell you the story from their end. But, you know, I kind of got into this whole rural America thing through my experience with Siskiyou County, where they have so many, a microcosm of the problems. But they've gone through the devastation of this spotted owl that's pretty much wiped out the timber industry. They've gone through this deal, a listing of a suckerfish that's really changed the whole dynamics of the river there and spent a lot of money and cost, I think, 1,200 ranchers their ranches and their homes. They're now going through the coho salmon as an excuse to take out three dams in Siskiyou County, the fourth being in Oregon, that are hydroelectric dams. And now, guess what? Here's OR7, this wolf that has, you know, a hero to some, and, you know, Darth Vader to others, has managed to tromp its way into Siskiyou County. I mean, how much can this poor county take? I mean, but it's not going to stop there. And so what's happening, I guess the point I want to make is exactly build on what you've just said, Dr. K. Here they come into California, and guess what? Hands off. Environmental Species Act applies. You cannot touch that wolf, and nobody knows what to do about it. That wolf just gets to run free.
Well, I'll tell you what was exciting about California. Yesterday, David Allen from Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation had a conference call with the California Fish and Game Director, telling him that you guys are making a huge mistake to start worshiping this wolf, as the students in the schools are getting the opportunity to name this wolf. I mean, that's what's going on. They're allowing the children to get involved with the ownership of that one wolf emotionally, and then when you go out to control them and shoot them, it's not going to work out too good. So,
well, they're never. I mean, in California, if you look at the mountain lion question and stuff,
yeah,
you know, they're never going to control or kill a wolf in California forever.
No,
you know, I mean, they passed. I mean, even if the state fish and game would do it, they'd put an initiative on the ballot. I'm sure green groups would. And you'd have to vote on it, and if mountain lions are killing and eating people, they don't particularly care because all the people live in cities and they're not impacted by it. So they vote to ban hunting, you know. And so there's no legal.
There's no legal. This is going to happen every state it goes into. Basically, you hit the same thing. My God, nobody can touch the damn thing, and this thing is spreading. That's probably what when the legislation went in, they knew this was going to be the case.
Yep.
So. This is coming to a neighborhood near you. If you're anywhere in the western states, for sure, and apparently up in the Michigan area now as well, the Great Lakes area, this is coming your direction. I know that there has been considerable kill of wild animals, elk, I guess, caribou, I don't know. There's been kills of, you know, home dogs, domestic dogs, and certainly of livestock. Have there been any at this point in time with people, humans, any risks or confrontations with humans?
There's a risk. There was a lady, a jogger, killed in Alaska a couple of years ago, and that just came out a month or two ago that they confirmed that was a wolf kill. But you have to go outside of North America to really look at human interaction and fatal attacks with wolves, because, you know, wolves are pretty much, they went from having a, you know, from the time Europeans landed on the shore, there was pretty much a bounty on wolves, and you know, they were shot at, their numbers were kept low, and you go to other areas of the world, and where you run into problems generally is where the government doesn't allow residents to have firearms. And, you know, there is significant documentation of fatal wolf attacks on people in the thousands upon thousands. But you just don't have that much of a history of it in North America. But that doesn't mean that they're not dangerous.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have an article that's coming out that's in press on man-eating wolves, where I look at man-eating by all large carnivores, okay, around the world, lions, leopards, I mean, African lions and everything else like that. And basically where it occurs, it's two things. The people are poor and they're unarmed, okay? And so that's why there's a whole lot of evidence from you know, Eurasia and Russia of wolves killing and eating people, because, I mean, did the Tsar want the peasants armed? I mean, did the communists want the peasants armed? I mean, does the current Russian oligarchy want the peasants
armed? Does Obama want us armed?
Well, no.
Let's bring it home, Jim. Let's bring it home.
Yeah, that's part of the whole thing. So that's why, you know, and from whenever the Europeans landed on the shore here, they were armed to the teeth because they were fighting the Native Americans on it. And, of course, the Native Americans were armed to the teeth because they had to live out here with each other, and they were killing each other and killing wolves and everything else. And so that's part of the reason the history is different in Europe versus here, because everybody's armed here, basically, and has been armed since 1492. On this stuff, on it like that. And so any wolf that was the least bit interested or curious or came around humans got killed on that stuff on it. That wasn't the case in Europe, and it's still not to this day.
Okay, that's good.
You don't want to be poor and underarmed in Africa. I mean, the Europeans in Africa, I mean, they took the people's spears even, okay?
Yeah, I know one thing. If I were one of the people I like to go out and walk and in the forest or hike in the forest to go on these trails and go backpacking, if there were wolves around, I'd have to give it a second thought.
I got to tell you something funny, guys, before I forget it. Everyone know who Lynn Stone is out of Sun Valley? Crazy Lynn?
No, not really.
Oh, you guys? She's
your problem, man.
Oh, fine. Okay. Charles, you know who she is. Anyway, she's one of these wolf nut lovers that goes out with telemetry, locates a wolf and shoots in the air to scare him off, and she's bragged about how she's not afraid of him. One of my buddies was out with her recently, and they were talking, and all of a sudden this gal looks behind Lynn, and here comes a wolf, and Lynn turns around and pulls out her pistol. Apparently there's a little hypocrisy with Lynn Stone, so we just found that out yesterday. So they are afraid of him.
She must have read about what's his name, Treadwell?
Yeah.
The nut in Alaska that got himself and his girlfriend eaten by a grizzly bear.
Yeah.
Now, so far we've talked a little bit about history, and we talked about kind of the progress. I'm sure in all this there's been the kind of science debates. I mean, let me know if there have been. I'm kind of curious what the science aspects of these are, because science seems to have no longer science. It's all politics and people getting paid off. But has there been a science component to all of this?
The trouble is, basically, you have to go back to President Eisenhower's farewell speech. He warned the country about two things: the military-industrial complex, which has sort of fallen by the wayside after 9/11, but he also warned the country what had happened when the government controls all the research. Okay, if you want to do research here in the States, you need to get a permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service. Okay, so that's a one-sided thing there, and then the research has been done other places like Canada. And I could go on that forever because I know the people up there. That research has been totally ignored, not been cited by anybody down here, either the feds or the Greens or anybody else. And the only other place is Alaska, where the state does their own research. Otherwise, everything's controlled and done by the Fish and Wildlife Service. You don't toe the line, you don't get the permit, you don't get the funding. It's very, very simple. So there hasn't been much of a science debate in that sense down here on that stuff, because where's the money on the other side? Okay.
Was there some kind of an initial environmental impact study or report that was done?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But the problem is, it was all a fraud from the start, because they only analyzed the impact of, three groups of 100 wolves each. So the whole thing is based on three wolves and rather small recovery areas. We're talking 300 wolves. That was the whole
environmental impact does not really consider the full impact of releasing wolves into the wild. I mean,
considered it within their own parameters. And if you know my history, I wrote the first thing on wolves in 1993. It's published in Peterson Hunting, and I warned. I'm the only ecologist who got it right. I warned everybody what was happening on it, and I was just ignored. Okay, the Fish and Wildlife, the whole EIS went through on it and everything else like that. And basically, it's the old camel nose underneath the tent situation. I've warned everybody it wasn't going to be cut off at 300 wolves. Okay. And, of course, if they analyzed, they only analyzed the impacts of 300 wolves. I mean, the hunters, everybody looked at, 300 wolves, everybody can sort of live with 300 wolves in three separate areas in three huge states. But the thing is, it was never going to stop there. It was never going to stop there. They had never to do it. And, of course, when I wrote that Peterson's Hunting article, what did the Fish and Wildlife Service try to do? They tried to have me fired from my university position. They called the president of the university. They call all the people that that work for them and got funding, and they had those people write letters to the university to try to get me fired, okay? That's how this all works out. And then when our congressman Jim Hansen here, and it's a long, more involved story, had set up for me to debate the Park Service, the superintendent of the Park Service, so this whole Yellowstone and the wolf thing and everything else on that thing on it, the President of the United States intervened, cut a deal with Newt Gingrich, and I got canceled. Between you and me, I mean, I don't follow politics much, but, you know, I'd vote for Obama before I'd vote for Newt Gingrich. He sold all the Western Republicans out, and I wouldn't touch Gingrich as far as I could throw him, from my personal experience, okay? He certainly sold me out. And this was before the Western States Coalition. Chenoweth was there, Cuban was there, all sorts of other people were there, and he just blew it all off.
In Idaho, for example, their unit, it was a 20,700 square mile unit that was supposed to be the representation for wolves. The fish and game guys exaggerated the prey base by 600%,
yep,
saying we had six times more elk than we actually did. Because they were so excited to get wolves. So you talk about science.
Oh, it's been fraud. I mean, you can go back to the Yellowstone, and there was a man named Mark Boyce, who used to be at the University of Wyoming. He's now up at Edmonton, okay? And they did a model as far as what impact the wolves were going to have on the Yellowstone elk situation. And basically his model showed the wolves were not going to have hardly any impact at all. And you won't understand what this means, but there's things called functional responses as far as how wolves handle prey. And there's four different kinds. Holling was the first person at the University of British Columbia who wrote all this stuff up. And there's two of us we call the type 2 functional response and type 3. Okay? And he modeled a type 3 functional response. And it's the only functional response that will stabilize the stuff. I have a friend who's an expert on predation and modeling. He took Mark Boyce's exact same model, exact computer codes, exact same numbers, except he substituted a type 2 functional response, which all the other modelers in the world use on that stuff, and the wolves took the elk to extinction, okay? So it's been fraud and scientific corruption right from the start. And that's what really gets me so upset, okay?
Well, I'm interested in this, particularly the science part of this and the fraud, because, you know, I'm sure the term limits, limitations have run on this, but, you know, I think if we can actually take a case where we can really debunk the science here on the wolf thing, we can get that word out and expand it to other aspects. I mean, just expose this whole process. For example, what you're telling me is the environmental impact study does not it bounds the conditions in a way that it really doesn't consider the real impact of a wolf release, because obviously this has gone well beyond what they were saying, and now we've got wolves that are wandering in the states under full protection. There's I would like to have. Does anybody have a copy of that original environmental impact study or know a link to it?
Oh, it's a great big thick thing.
Idaho for Wildlife website, under resource and data, you can find it right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've written a whole series, and Steve Aller has them on his website.
Yeah, it's
I've written
on
a whole series of popular articles explaining all the predation stuff in simple terms where people can understand as far as predator-mediated competition, the landscape of fear, and all sorts of other things that these predators do that no one talks about, okay? And it's in the scientific literature. I can support all this stuff by scientific study on it. But, you know, everybody just ignores it. The press ignores all this stuff on it. Oh, the thing, I don't know what you said about livestock there, Dave, at the start, okay? But these numbers that they use, you know, like they say there's 2 or 3 million, say there's 3 or 4 million, whatever the number is, a cattle in Montana, and the wolves only kill a couple hundred. What's the problem? Okay? It's called lying with statistics, because all the wolves in Montana, all the cattle in Montana aren't subject to wolf predation. And there was, matter of fact, Wildlife Service people presented a paper on this at the Wolf Symposium, which was held in Sheridan, Wyoming a number of years ago by the Wyoming Animal Damage Control Board on this kind of stuff on it. You need to look at the whole wolf depredation on livestock thing a different way. And you have to ask the question, what percentage of the wolf packs that have livestock in their territory sooner or later have turned to killing livestock? And the number is 100%. And I have this in writing both from the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Wildlife Services people. Okay, so that's a whole different aspect then on this whole livestock depredation thing, where basically every wolf pack sooner or later turns to killing livestock. It's a never-ending problem. Sorry. You don't want to get me talking about wolves.
No, please. I mean, feel free. This is the place to vent because, you know, Dr. K, you and I never had a chance to talk, and Keith, I haven't talked to you or Steve either. But just to let you know, this Defend Rural America project is a project to try and pull together under a single umbrella all these various aspects. You know, rural America seems to be, you know, kind of the, in my opinion, it's the reservoir of, you know, family values. It's the reservoir of, you know, the American ideals and the American, you know, dream, and hardworking people that just want to take care, you know, leave me alone. I want to do my thing. And, you know, if I have a problem, I'll deal with it myself. So pretty much that's how they've been. They've been kind of doing things on their own, not really realizing that this is happening necessarily in other communities, or not really being the type that want to, you know, get government funding or do this or do that. They're trying to deal with the problems on their own. And so you have, you know, people who are, you know, dams are getting blown up here, and it turns out 1,000 dams across the United States have been blown up now. You've got, you know, these endangered species thing. You have, you can actually look on Google Maps and look at the Central Valley in California, the San Joaquin Valley. From a satellite perspective, you can see a dead space that's created in the most productive farmland in the United Nations because of the so-called Delta smelt. I guess what I'm saying is that they are not isolated incidences. It is a plan. I hope the sooner we come to realize that. So Defend Rural America becomes umbrella under which we bring together the ideas of defending all aspects of that. That includes miners, that includes timbermen, that includes ranchers and farmers. And, you know, the message that I give to the audience is, look, it's a small part of our population, but it's 95% of our land. It's where our water comes from. It's where our, you know, food comes from. It's where our energy comes from. It's where our, you know, minerals and so forth come from. Look, this is the backbone of the national prosperity, and when it's being destroyed, we have to fight back. So this whole radio show, so you know, this episode is actually one of a series of shows that is peeling back one by one the various aspects that are attacking rural America. I'll be interested in looking at that environmental impact report. Have you articles, I guess, that have been written up, maybe exposing that as well?
Well, Charles, I haven't talked about that. Yeah, I haven't talked, just touched on the EIS a little bit like that. The other thing you have to understand too, okay. You have to look at these judges' ruling and these, how do I want to put this, activist judges like Malloy, okay? You've had a ruling out of an Oregon court on a lawsuit, the wolves, that says the wolves have to be restored to their full historic range, which is damn near the whole United States, okay? And you've had, I don't know if you know about this Center for Biodiversity out of Arizona, okay? Mm-hmm. They've already said they're going to sue the federal government to come up with an EIS for wolf reintroduction in every state in the nation, okay? This is not just a Western problem. It's going to be everybody's problem.
Okay. So they're not even going to wait for the wolves to go trops across the boundaries. They're going to try and accelerate the process.
Yeah, yeah.
So much for an agreement, huh?
Yeah, well, the same thing would happen. And I'm not haven't followed the Mexican wolf stuff that closely, but that's all in a turmoil there because they can't get the wolves to take, and they're not trying to write a new EIS now, and all of a sudden it pops up that they want wolves in southern Utah and stuff, which the feds admit is outside their normal historical range, but they can go do it anyhow the way various courts have interpreted the law. I mean, they put wolves down there in the Kaibab and stuff in the Arizona Strip, and they get into Pavant, and basically some of the best mule deer hunting, which is hardly any left, good trophy mule deer hunting in the whole United States, and that's all another question. I mean, you're right. You're dropping these wolves right on top of that stuff, and that's their plan.
That's their plan. Yeah, it's. I mean, they're being successful with destroying hunting in Montana and Idaho and Wyoming. You might just, you know, well, if you're successful, why not just keep pushing it out across the country?
Yeah. Well. You know, I told everybody that was their plan back in 93. Nobody listened. I'm glad some people are trying to actually figure this out, and especially because now that you're seeing the direct impacts of all this stuff. You know, I mean,
these agencies doing anything to try and control this, or are they just kind of laissez-faire, let it go?
Yeah. It all has to do with
to
money
it?
And control from the federal government, okay?
From the environmental groups.
I mean, that's part of the reason the state...
The other thing to look at as well is what is the real stronghold of the Second Amendment? It's hunters. And if you take away the will of the people to hunt, who's going to be there to defend the Second Amendment?
Well, if there's nothing to hunt, why, you know, you don't need the firearms anyhow, right?
Well, that's going to be their argument.
Oh, I know it's going to be their argument. I hate to say it, that's going to be their argument, okay? This stuff.
Now, I used to, as a young lad, go up to Idaho and spend a lot of nice summers, and occasionally would wander on over into Jackson Hole, and I know they had the elk herds come in the winter, which was kind of a tourist thing to go in and see them feeding them there. Eric was a caribou, I think it was elk. But in any case, what's the story there? Has that been affected?
Yeah, how much time you got? Is this a five-hour radio show?
Well, give us the short version.
Well, in Jackson Hole, it's not only wolves that come in, but you got to grab them with the grizzlies too. Okay.
What's been the impact of the wolves, though?
The moose numbers. Look at the moose numbers. They've fallen right off the end of the earth. The hunting permits stuff. The moose have fallen off the end of the earth on this kind of stuff on this thing. And the elk numbers have gone decreased down there too. Basically, any place where you've had high numbers of wolves. And there's not a lot. There's hardly any livestock left in Jackson Hole on that stuff. So the only so there's not a lot of depredation on livestock. So the wolves haven't been controlled by the federal government and stuff. And the only thing that saved us so far, the reason we don't have wolves in Utah or Colorado and stuff on this kind of stuff, at least in any large number that anybody's owning up to, is once those wolves leave the wilderness areas in Idaho, and they leave the wilderness areas in Yellowstone Park where there's no livestock, and they come out, you know, to spread, they run into livestock and then do this depredation stuff, and they've been immediately controlled by the federal government. And that was supposed to be the plan in Oregon out there, and they would have all these depredations. They've only have a handful of wolves in Oregon. They're already eating cows, okay, on this kind of stuff. And so under the state plan, they were supposed to remove these depredating wolves, but the green people who agreed to the state plan went into court, and some judge stopped it, okay? And they also stopped. They were supposed to get rid of depredating wolves out of New Mexico, and that Center for Biodiversity went to court, and that's all stopped, too. They're no longer killing depredating wolves in Arizona and New Mexico.
I understand that what happened in Jackson Hole, kind of taking you back to that, because it's so personal to me. I remember, you know, Jackson Hole is a great place. If anybody's never been there, it's a beautiful place, and Jenny's Lake and the Wirt Hotel and, you know, the Central Park there with the elk hordes, I think it is, that I had heard that they no longer even feed them because there's so few left. Is that correct?
No, they still feed them. The state maintains 22 feed grounds, okay, but the big one you're talking about is a federal feed ground. It's a national elk refuge right there in Jackson Hole on it and stuff.
Correct,
yeah,
that one.
And actually, they've been over their herd objective for a long time because, and I've just read a book, there's just a publication recently on this by a man who used to work on this stuff. They haven't actually had that many problems with wolves coming into that and chewing on those big herds on the feed lines and stuff on it because the wolves just get, the elk just gang up on them. So they've had some in there and stuff on it. And, of course, the wolves prey on them all summer when they're not on the feed ground and stuff like that. But they haven't had that much impact on the big one there. On some of the smaller state feed grounds, like there's three up to Gravant on that stuff on it, they've had them there where the wolves have just run the elk right out of them. And then I have a friend who works for Wyoming Game and Fish who feeds elk in the winter over on the Green River side. Okay, and they have had a hell of a problem there in some cases where the wolves coming in and then chasing the elk off of the feed grounds. Then, of course, the elk go down into where the livestock is on it, compete with the livestock, and, of course, those elk are also full of brucellosis and stuff. And so it's a whole long – it's a whole mess. We could talk about this for hours, okay?
Has anybody done any modeling to project how the population of these wolves will grow?
Well, I mean, to me, modeling is a dirty word, okay?
Well,
one thing I never did. I never do is
model. An honest model.
Well, there's nobody doing honest models, okay, because who's going to fund it, okay? There's not. I mean, the only modeling that's being done is people like Mark Boyce, who did that stuff originally, or other people who are working for the federal government that are doing this kind of stuff, who are getting their paychecks through various grants and everything else from the government. I mean, basically, they're spreading at their population is increasing, you know, at 20% or more a year. Just figure it out. They have to go someplace. Okay.
Well, what's interesting, if I just put out my calculator, and if you say we got 4,000 wolves and they came from 68 wolves, that's a multiply of 59 times growth from, you know, 1995 till today. So in 16 years, it's gone 58 times.
Yeah, I think there was more than 68 wolves. I mean, there was some that went into Yellowstone and some went into Wyoming. And I don't know, Steve Alder probably has a better idea of how many went into Idaho and stuff.
Well, it started out with 10, 12, and then each year it just kept bringing them in. And then once we, Idaho Fish and Game, illegally signed those permits against state legislature code, Fish and Wildlife went on a frenzy and were helicoptering and flying them in everywhere. In fact, Ed Bangs wrote me emails how they brought wolves in into every available piece of habitat in the state, in the north central Idaho. So they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't trust the feds to count, trust them to count wolves now, I mean, you know, who knows how many they left loose, okay? But it doesn't take many wolves. I mean, they have a high reproductive rate, you know. They're almost
now,
like bunnies.
Clearwater, central Idaho, I have a different opinion than Fish and Game. In fact, I have a different opinion than almost everybody. We saw the wolves come in hard, and we saw the buildup of the saturation levels from in 2006 and 7. And starting in the spring of 2007 in the backcountry, we feel that they hit their saturation level. We started seeing less wolves. So then they moved into the little towns and that, you know, these little farm areas. It's like what Dr. K did. It said they get in the backcountry where they can't gravitate down to a ranch. What they do is they gravitate during the winter and follow the elk down into where these little canyons where the winter, you know, and they kill them. So the elk almost go extinct in the backcountry. Then the wolves follow out and then start getting in trouble. But the backcountry is almost sterile.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened.
Go ahead. We're seeing a phenomenon in the Bitterroot here, and it, you know, when you go back and look at the history of Lewis and Clark coming across the Bitterroot, they almost starved to death. I mean, there weren't any animals in the mountain, and you wonder, you know, they saw all the writings of the elk were over in the breaks, the Missouri River breaks, and in the valleys, and you know, of course, there were wolves back then, and now we're starting to see in the Bitterroot and in some different areas. Now that these elk are under the threat of predation from wolves, they're moving into areas where, you know, in the last 200 years we haven't seen elk. They're down in the valleys again. They're moving out of the mountains into the valleys, and they're living in residential neighborhoods. And, you know, I'm just wondering, Dr. K, what's your take on that?
Well, that's what happened up in the Canadian Rockies, okay? I mean, basically, I mean, when the wolves came in, and let me just tell you, the Canadian people, the Parks Canada, fully admits what the wolves have done, okay, unlike down here and everything else like that. They haven't had the corruption of science and stuff going on there. So they fully admit once the wolves have naturally recolonized the Canadian Rockies after being wiped out the last time under a rabies scare in the 50s or 60s, that the elk numbers have dropped 80 to 90%. And the elk start living in the town of Banff, and they start living in the town of Jasper up there, because they go into the town to escape the wolf predation and this kind of stuff like that. And so, and the other thing that's happened, and this is what Steve was referring to, it's happened in Yellowstone. If you look at the numbers, not only of elk on the northern range in Yellowstone, they've gone from a count of 19,000 down to 4,665 last winter. The number of wolves has fallen now, too. And that's what happened in Banff. They took the elk population so low that the wolves actually winked out of the system, and then all the green people up there were saying they needed double and triple the size of the national park so they could at least have a couple of wolf packs left. Well, the wolves winked out of the system, and then, of course, the elk numbers come up a little bit, and then the wolves just move back in and keep them at this very, very low level. There's been a lot of research done on wolves and Canadian Rockies on that, you know, and they have those kinds of impact. And then, of course, when the elk numbers fall, the wolves turn to killing each other more. And that's what's happened in Yellowstone. They document that stuff. That's what certainly happened in Canada, too. They're basically fighting over scarce resources. The wolves are territorial. There's less for them to eat. And they just go to more border conflicts on it, and they wind up killing each other.
And our Lolo herd is about 5% of its original population, and that seems to be about the right balance. And I think that's what the Enviros want.
Yeah, I hate the word balance, too, because that's full balance of nature stuff, and that's all.
That's what I know. I'm just saying what makes them happy.
Yeah, well, as you well know, there's a few words that set me off because they used incorrectly, and they're used all the time in the green stuff, that trying to get some idea that's balance of nature. Well, there was never any balance of nature. Okay.
Steve, you're in Idaho there. What has been the response in Idaho to this?
Well, you know, I've been involved watching the absolute corruption on with our states. I was out chartering flights and during the predation buildup in the Lola, watching, documenting it, going out there living with them, and coming back and reporting and with pictures, and I was classified as an alarmist and a troublemaker and to shut up and go away, and this went on for years, and finally we figured out between Charles Kay and Val Geis, I had to be self-taught what was going on, and we saw the elk plummet, and then we saw the wolves drop severely in the backcountry, I'm saying. And then we saw a little comeback when the wolves were gone. In a couple of years, you'd see a few more elk, and then they hit them again. As soon as the elk start coming back, you have a safe pocket of elk for a while, and then, damn, the wolves find them, and it's all over again. So, and of course, the deep snow, 07 and 08 were horrible winters. They don't have a chance when they winter down along those canyons. So problem is we had fish and game. And Charles has told me this I don't know how many times, but the science was flawed. Their science in 2006 was basically saying it's all habitat. And what does Defenders of Wildlife say? It's all habitat. And their studies, 2006 study to remove 43 wolves from the Lolo, the study comes back and says it's habitat. It's killing all your elk. So you can't kill them. It nullifies the 10J. So Ed Bing says, oh, sorry, guys. Can't go kill any wolves. Damn habitat's killing them, those poor elk.
I think recently, haven't they, Idaho started to go ahead and issue hunting permits?
Yeah, we've got a season currently that's, you know, it's more effective than it has been. The official game plan on getting helicopters out and do some flying. The problem is in the backcountry in Lolo, we got 4 months of wolf hunting, and they've taken six wolves. Five of them have been trapped. And you know, you look at Idaho County and the size of it, and this hunting is a joke, which we knew.
Well,
that was the thing, is that the environmentalists, every time a hunting season was announced, the blogs would come out, oh, wolves are going to go extinct, and it's like, you know, anybody in their right mind, you know, knew that hunting isn't even going to be an effective management tool, let alone have them go extinct over it.
No, and another thing that's interesting is we had almost 20,000 elk in the Lolo in 1988, in the late 80s, and I wrote a letter to a legislator in 2008 saying you got about 2,000 left, and the next year their study showed 2,000. And then now we're hearing reports of 500 to maybe 1,000 elk left in the Lolo.
And what was the number originally?
One of the largest elk herds on the planet, and now we've got 5 to 1,000 elk left in the Lolo.
What was the original number again?
It was up as high as 20,000, but between 16,000 and 18,000.
Down to 500 to 1,000.
Yes.
That's a severe drop. Do you have, I'll be interested, I want to ask the same question of Bob in Montana, but do you have in Idaho legislature, the state legislature, or your federal representatives, senators, or whatever else, or even your county commissioners, I mean, do you have somebody that is pushing back on all this stuff and trying to defend rural America there?
We do. Are you talking to me as far as Idaho?
Well, I'm talking about Idaho.
In 2011, we came out with a bill, H.R. 343, for an emergency wolf bill, and it passed unanimously. And it's put a lot of heat on the governor. And so far, we haven't had to execute it because we've had the ability to manage wolves because of the Simpson CR. So our state legislature, they're moved up. They're pretty aggressive on this right now.
Well,
the problem is the damage has been done in Idaho's backcountry. It's pretty well over.
The other problem is there's really nothing the state can do about it, because I don't know if this came up before. People say that when Congress put that rider on there, they delisted the wolves. That's not true. The wolves are not delisted. All that rider did
was reestablish the 209 delisting regulations, okay? So all these states, Montana and Idaho, under this 5-year probation period, okay? And all the, you know, and so they can, and if they don't keep their numbers up or whatever they tried to do on this kind of stuff, on all of that, the feds will either take the control back from them or they'll get sued by the various environmental groups on this thing, on this stuff. So the wolves haven't really been delisted. And the other thing is everybody knew from the beginning who had two functional gray cells. You go back to Alaska, and there's all sorts of data back there. I mean, how did I figure this out in 93 when no one else did? I mean, there's all this data that's sitting there. If you know, you know, if you're not a whore, you know, and you're not looking for your funding from the federal government, trapping and hunting will not control a wolf population. You'll be lucky if they take the annual increase, which they never do. Okay? All right. And so the only legal recourse the state has right now is hunting and trapping. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, for what? They sold 30 or 35,000 licenses in Idaho, and they haven't even killed 200 wolves. You know, it's less than a half of 1% a hunter's success on this kind of stuff on this thing. You know, I lived in Alaska for a couple years. I'm a hunter. I never did ever get a wolf in the crosshairs, okay? I mean, they're very smart animals, especially when they're hunted. They turn nocturnal. They can be worse than white-tailed deer as far as going nocturnal when you have heavy hunting pressure on this kind of stuff on it like that, on it. And you just can't do it. So that's the only tool they have. And if they try aerial gunning them from helicopters, they're going to get sued. Okay. You can only do the states can only do what's in their approved state management plan.
Yeah, well, I think we have to start reassessing jurisdiction here. That's one of the things we've had an earlier show on. But I wanted to make sure. Hang on a second, Doctor.
Okay.
One of the things that I firmly believe that we have to do to start winning these battles is we have, you know, there's generally a natural inclination to find the congressmen and the representatives that we don't like and waste a lot of time on that. And we spend almost zero time identifying the ones that are on our side and standing behind them and helping to promote them and so forth. So what I guess I'm trying to encourage is if you have a few political people in Idaho at any level that you feel are heroes that are actually there for the right reasons, please name them, because I like to see the people of Idaho and elsewhere support these people. Do you have any congressmen, for example, or senators that are on board and really leading the parade or not? Sounds like a good quiet dead space there.
Yeah, Charles, you saw this email regarding Labrador today and Crapo. I mean, look what happens when they get some of that water from the Potomac River. They're worthless.
But you,
well,
me,
what they're
but
doing
let
is
me
they're
finish
they're,
this point before you go away and wander onto another topic. Is there no representative in California in Idaho that you feel is on the people's side and pushing this forward?
Not really. Nope.
That's a sad commentary. People from Boise, Idaho, you need to get on board this. You know, I was born in Pocatello. You guys need to get on board this. It's time that we start electing representatives that represent your interests.
Yeah, not on a national level. Today is an example. We had an email from Crapo that infuriated us. Then we get one from Paul Labrador that's just about the same language.
What do you expect? They're running for re-election, okay?
I know.
They want to piss off, excuse me, for using that word, okay? But, you know, they want to upset as few voters as possible. And where's the big voting blocks? Well, you know, it's all there sitting there in Boise, people living in cities. Just like here in Utah, 80 or 90% of the people live along the Wasatch Front. They do their public opinion surveys. They all love wolves. They don't live with them, okay? It would be rural Utah where the impact would come on this stuff on it. But to get back to what you were talking about as far as jurisdiction, unless you can figure some way to get rid of the Endangered Species Act and change a bunch of federal laws and a bunch of court cases and stuff on this stuff, trust me, you don't have a prayer, okay?
Gentlemen, this is Terry Dodd. I've been laying back and being quiet, as I know Red Beckman has too, because Red, as I said before, has been on all over this topic in the past, and he's spoken at rallies up in Montana and has, you know, tried to encourage the people to understand that they need to be able to judge the law and recognize that they have every right to judge that law. First of all, and I hope I didn't miss somebody else mentioning this, but the wolves that have been released up there are Canadian wolves. They're not Montana wolves. They're not native wolves to that territory. They're a much larger and much more prolific wolf, and the people that have released them are fully aware of that. And so, you know, you're not fighting a battle of science. You're not fighting a battle of logic. You're fighting people who have deliberately and willfully attacked that community. And the only way to stop them is for the people to recognize that these outsiders do not have the right to come in there and dictate what your law is in your state. If one of you, if any one of you, this question is directly for any one of you, if any one of you were serving on a grand jury and you were brought the case that somebody shot a wolf, would you convict them or suggest that they should be investigated and indicted? Or would you acquit them? Would you say, no, they should not be prosecuted? Because that's where the decision on making the decision on judging the law comes in. If in the 1800s the people understood this, and if they were called to a jury duty, whether it be a grand jury or a petit jury, they knew that they had the right to judge the law, and no judge was going to tell them different. And if the law was bad, they just simply would not prosecute or indict anybody under that bad law, and the law went away because the people understood their right. You guys are talking about licensing hunting seasons on these wolves. As far as I'm concerned, they're pests, and they should be able to be shot on sight. It doesn't matter what time of the year it is, and no jury up there in that state should ever convict anybody for it.
Yeah, well,
Red,
Charles can handle that one.
Well, yeah. No, I stay out of that because that's all political stuff. You need to talk to John Rumpf, okay? A lot of those cases you're referring to was before the Civil War. Things changed after the Civil War where you got a centralized government. But that's legal stuff. I don't get involved in that thing. They'd never put me on a grand jury. They never put me on any jury whatsoever, okay, on that stuff, on that thing. But that's another type of stuff. But, you know, I understand what you're saying, but personally, you know, I wouldn't want to be the person pulling the trigger in the stand on that legal argument because they're going to send you, you know.
Dr. K, would you throw in your two cents on, because the wildlife biologists that I've spoken with, and even ones that I would consider, you know, I don't want to call them anti-wolf, but people that at least have been on the truthful side of the wolf issue, they have said to a man that, you know, this whole idea of this supersized Canadian wolf really doesn't have any merit. And in fact, the wolves that are north of I-90 in Montana came, you know, across the border on their own, and they're the same wolf that we released. But, like, for instance, Val Geist, Dave Meach, all these guys said it really didn't matter what wolf we put in here. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, this will get me in a lot of trouble, okay?
Oh, I'll back you, Charles.
Yeah, we've gone around and around about this stuff on various things on this thing. And basically, unless you show me the dead wolf, okay? I mean, all these people said they saw stuff. You know, I'm not saying that they didn't see stuff. But there's basically no data to support that. I mean, they're all one species, okay? This is the thing. I mean, basically, what these green groups are trying to do is cut out various species. There's people that are trying to say the wolves on the Alaska coastal stuff on the panhandle, okay, by Juneau and stuff. They're trying to say that's a whole separate species of wolves now that you need to be given full separate ESA protection. You got people back in the Northeast that are trying to claim that timber wolf is a different species, okay. You got people in New Mexico down there. Those guys trying to say that, well, that's a different species or subspecies than the red wolf and all that kind of stuff. Hell, they all interbreed, okay, and they have. Dog DNA in them and all sorts of other stuff on that. It's all one species. And that basically the Fish and Wildlife, if you look the way the law is, they can do whatever they want to do. And that's what they did. And even if you're right, even if those people are right, and there was some little wolf that was left back there in the wilderness, which for various biological reasons is probably not true on that stuff, it's a done deal. They're already here. Basically the size of the animals, whether it's ungulates, just a minute, I got to close my office door.
Well, he's doing that, I'm going to jump in, actually, and just say the same thing's going on with the coho salmon, and that, you know, they're basically claiming that the hatchery-raised coho salmon are somehow different than those that, you know, lay their eggs in the stream, and therefore they don't count. I mean, it's pretty interesting, the whole idea of of subdividing species and basically broadening this Endangered Species Act in the areas that, you know, you never do. I mean, you get down, they could take that to the level of individual personality characteristics, and then by that definition, everyone is endangered.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the problems. You don't have an Endangered Species Act. You have an Endangered Species, Subspecies, and Distinct Population Segments, and there's no agreed-upon definition of subspecies or distinct population segments, so it's what lawyers would call arbitrary and capricious. You can do whatever you want, and that's what the feds do. When it's to their advantage to rule one way, they rule that way. And the thing is, you read this, someone leaked a draft of the Mexican Wolf Renew EIS, and the feds are just admitting they would love to have some wolves come down out of Yellowstone and Idaho and breed with those Mexican wolves because they're so inbred, okay? Well, and how are they trying to claim they need to save Mexican wolves because they're a separate species or subspecies? It's just, you know, whatever they want, they can do it around, and as long as you can get some judge to agree with them and stuff, you know, that's what's happened with this kind of thing like that.
Well,
so,
let me read a paragraph, and this is from Theodore Roosevelt's Hunting Trips of a Ranchman in 1893. This tells you about these little wolves we had. And he says, quote, "The big timber wolves of the northern Rocky Mountains attack every four-footed beast to be found where they live. They are," now let me just paraphrase here. He says, "a bull elk or bull moose, when on its guard, makes a most dangerous fight. But a single wolf will frequently master the cow of either animal, as well as domestic cattle and horses. In attacking such large game, however, the wolves like it to act in concert." Anyway, talks about how they do it, but he claims that one of these wolves will kill an ordinary horse. So anyway, they were a terrible animal back then.
Yeah,
also.
the size of the wolves or the size of the elk or the size of the elephants and things on it depends on how much food they have available. Okay, it's just like the wolves in Yellowstone and the Northern Range are getting smaller now. The average weight's going down because there's less food for them kinds of things on it like that. So when they first put them in there, it was like walking into a, you know, the elk there hadn't seen a wolf in almost 100 years on it and things on it. You had all these elk there and stuff, and they were, you know, you had huge packs and double breeding in the packs, multiple breedings in the packs, which wasn't seen that much before and anything else like that. And, you know, the wolves were well over 100 pounds, some were up to 150 pounds and things on it. And, you know, as they start running out of food, they get smaller.
We've seen
the same thing in
Idaho. We've seen lesser, smaller wolf packs and smaller weighted, a lot smaller wolves. A lot of hungry wolves in the backcountry.
Yep. A lot of wolves trying to kill each other.
And Dr. Geist has said this is how it works. It's predicated on their food supply, size of the packs, size of the animal.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, that you got those little small black-tailed deer out on the coast, okay? And they're, you know, they call them a different subspecies of mule deer, though it's all the same species on it. You take those little small mule deer, and these studies were done in the 50s by a man named Cowan at the University of British Columbia. You put them in a fen, feed them a high-quality diet, and they'll get bigger than your average mule deer. It has nothing to do with difference in genetics. It's the fact that all that's up on the coast, it's been leached so much by the high rainfall, the nutrients are all gone out of the soil. So even though you have all this vegetation there, it's pretty much worthless as deer food. And so that's why the deer are small, same way with the Sitka black-tailed deer and everything up to the coast like that. The reason they're small and short is because they have low-quality food. You put them in a pen, feed them high-quality stuff, you grow huge things. Same way with elk. That's why
I'm going to go back
small
and address the question to Bob, because I'm really kind of interested in solutions. I think we have a pretty good idea of the picture of the problem at this point. Bob, do you have in Montana any representatives or senators or, you know, even local politicians that are on the people's side in this?
Well, we elected a bunch of Tea Party people in our county here the last election. So as far as federal representation, no. We're, you know, maybe Denny Rehberg, and I'm not sure that I trust him a whole lot either. But, you know, the thing that we do have possibly is this idea of coordination, this idea that, that, you know, you and I as citizens don't have standing, but our local government does have standing. And the local government, if you've got the political will there, you know, can come up with solutions, and the federal government is forced to consider those solutions. And actually, I believe if to shoot down that solution, they've got to have a damn good reason. So again, Keith can probably talk about that maybe even a little deeper than I can, but that even more so than maybe more so than electing having elected officials that you can trust. I mean, Wyoming's got Cynthia Lummis, I think, is probably pretty good from what I know of her, but she's the one that that introduced that Government Litigation Savings Act, which needs to be passed, because if we can cut off some of the funding to these thieves, we can maybe make some headway. But Keith, what do you know about the coordination and how that might be used?
Bob, I don't think Keith's on anymore.
Okay. Well, I don't know if anybody else knows much about that, but
The person to talk to you about that is Karen Budd Fallon. I don't know if she's the one that started it, but she's been the one that worked with those counties in New Mexico there that have caused all that fuss with the federal government and stuff like that. And I've heard her speak at a different number of conferences and stuff on it. And I know there's other lawyers who are expert in that kind of stuff on it. You know, where there's some, I forget which federal law it is, but there's some law that says they have to court. I mean, basically the counties would have special standing, and they don't even have to, like, they have this standing to be able to work with the government before they actually produce the EIS. So it's not just a matter of commenting on a draft EIS. They're supposed to be in there actually helping and commenting on whether it's a forest plan or BLM resource management plan. I mean, I've been involved in that a little bit, doing some work for San Juan County when the federal government, the BLM, was revising their resource management plans on it. The government people were telling one thing about wildlife, and they didn't believe it, so they hired me, and I went out and measured it. And we had to collect some data then to be able to submit to the BLM in this particular case and then to the Forest Service and their forest plan letter. But they have a special status to be able to get in there. You need to talk to a lawyer about that. I mean, I know about it a little bit because I do some private consulting and stuff on it like that.
Well, Karen Budd Fallon has been retained by River Valley County, Montana. I brought her up here, actually, and the county went ahead and decided to retain her. And we are, River Valley County, Montana, is going through the process of coordination, not only on the wolf issue, but on water rights, mining, natural resource extraction, the travel plan, timber. It's a good thing, we got some Tea Party people in that have the political will to take this on. But
and just, you know, there is
one
of the other attorneys that's involved in this is actually outside of Boise, Idaho, and he's pretty well known, Fred Kelly Grant. And Steve, if you don't know him, you probably ought to get to know him. But he's an elderly fellow, but he's in the middle of this, and he made a presentation to the Redding Tea Party here in Northern California. That is on YouTube, and you can see the entire presentation there. And it's excellent. I think it's Redding Tea Party Patriots or Redding. I can get to the YouTube channel, but there's a great one. You can actually watch him talk about coordination. It's a 10th Amendment issue.
Yeah.
I think it really is something that people are grabbing onto here because it is a requirement. I had a very informative dialogue today with another fellow from Siskiyou County, and we talked a little bit about this, and I can add, I'm going to just kind of repeat a little bit of what he said. His is Ray Haupt. He's a forester in California, worked for the government, and now he's retired from that, and he's teaching 2 days a week, and he's a professional registered forester here, and so he knows the ins and outs of the law. And under the NEPA Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, there is also a coordination requirement in there consistent with rulings of the court and consistent with the 10th Amendment and so forth. There are no penalties, however, for federal agents who don't follow the coordination process correctly. They get the hand slapped. On the other hand, the Environmental Species Act has a concept called consultation, where the agency that wants to do a project has to consult with the regulatory agencies that might be involved to oversee this. And under that process, the agencies work together under process of consultation, and the person who ultimately makes the decision what to do going forward is personally liable for violation of the Endangered Species Act and can have penalties of $10,000 or $20,000 or more assessed against the individual. So guess who wins out? So people need to really – I'm going to have this up on the website here shortly. People need to understand that under NEPA, you have coordination under – under the Environmental Species Act, you have consultation between agencies, and the consultation goes on in private, and we have to learn and understand the system and start to expose that and use, discovery requests, requests to get involved in that process and to get copies of the communications and get involved in that process, because that one turns out to be the back channel that's hidden to public, where a lot of decisions are actually getting made and ultimately make the determination, and all we're doing is engaging in the other end of it. So for those who are involved in coordination, also understand and learn about the consultation part of this that's under the Endangered Species Act. I think we're going to have to get involved in both of those to become effective. Are there any...
Kurt, we have a caller... We have a caller from area code 406. Are we ready to take a question from somebody, guys?
Yes. This is Clarice Ryan. I'm calling from Big Fork, Montana. I do know that Dan Happel, one of the county commissioners in Montana, and also Susie Foss out of Hamilton, have both been very active in trying to get this coordination process started. It is a county government that can take on the federal government at an equal level through coordination to force consistency at the local level. And it involves the counties with the federal government in planning and coordinating the policies on different issues that they may originally have disagreed on. So it is the county that can call in the federal government to sit down at the table and deal with them. It is not cooperation necessarily. Cooperation does not have the federal endorsement and strength behind it. And Dan Happel is one person that has worked with this. I have a phone number for him as well as Susie Foss if you're interested in that. But I would like to warn you that in getting involved with a lawsuit at the same time as coordination, once a lawsuit has been issued on an issue, then the federal government is not required or is not forced to come to the table because of the procedure that establishes. It has to be a coordination level at an equal level.
Yeah, and Susie Foss is one of our county commissioners. Susie Foss,
good,
that she mentioned.
Yeah, she had a workshop that she invited county commissioners to, and it was Dan and Margaret Byfield who put that on. They had worked with this Fred Kelly Grant. Fred Kelly Grant is the one who has been covering all of the western states, as far back as Nebraska, to encourage the county commissioners to take a stand. They have a lot more authority and power than they have been utilizing. And just recently, the sheriffs have begun getting involved in this from the standpoint of safety, security, and health. And the Forest Service that has been closing up gates and decommissioning roads have endangered the lives of people because you can't get in to fight forests, you can't get in to rescue people. But when the sheriffs are getting involved, they are beginning to be even more effective than the county commissioners, it seems. And they're having a convention in Las Vegas this month. And that is going to be for all the sheriffs in the United States will be getting involved in that. I think it's this month. Let me see.
Clarice.
Yes. Yes.
This is Terry Dodd. We had Sheriff Mack on a few weeks ago, along
yes.
with some of the other constitutional sheriffs out there in Northern California. And he talked about his conference that he's putting on at the end of this month. And they are planning on having at least 200 sheriffs at that conference, and we are encouraging that. We We actually, if we could have gotten a white paper submitted, we would have been able to send somebody to speak at that conference. But we're aware of that, and we've also got your telephone number, and I want to ask for permission to follow up with you after the, you know, tomorrow or sometime after the show to discuss this further. I know that Kurt also has your number now. Is it okay if we contact you off the air?
I'd love to have you, because I have been following this very closely with Fred Kelly Grant. Fred Kelly Grant was able to actually stop the Trans-Texas Corridor using this coordination process by getting four communities that highway from Texas up to Kansas City would have wiped out four communities.
But,
and
Clarice,
those little tiny towns, yes?
You mean you're a Rick Perry fan?
I beg your pardon?
I said, do you mean you're a Rick Perry fan?
No. He was in favor of that highway, and they were able to stop that using coordination. What I'm doing, trying to say, is that Fred Kelly Grant knows that coordination process can be used in all types of issues. Wolves is one thing that Susie Foss right now in Hamilton is using it to get control of the wolf population and to get the communities to fight that. Dan Happel got, yes?
We will follow up with you on this. I was teasing about Rick Perry. do you have a question? Do you have a question for any of our guys?
No, I just heard the subject of coordination come up in relation to Karen Bud Phelan, and I wanted to warn people that they should not get involved at the same time with a lawsuit, because that would defeat the whole ability to get the feds to the table for a coordination process. They would not be required to deal with you once a lawsuit is started.
I can't speak for the rest of the gentlemen on this show. I'll let them speak for themselves, but I quite frankly think the best way to coordinate with the feds is to have the county sheriff tell them to stay out of their county.
Absolutely. It's beginning to look as though they are more effective. The sheriffs have more interest in this and more power than the county commissioners have exhibited in most cases, although this has been successful in many, many states where you do have county commissioners that are willing to take it on and take advantage of it. But the sheriffs seem to be more intensely concerned about the health, safety, and welfare of the population. What I have seen is that the county commissioners tend to be more interested in land management and planning and zoning and snow removal, that type of thing. But the sheriffs are the ones that, Sheriff Mack and using that coordination process, they may prove themselves even more successful in using that technique. And what we need to do is be sure that you do not mix that in your mind with cooperation. Cooperation leaves the feds in the driver's seat, and they invite you in, and they explain to you what their policies are going to be, and you can comment on that. It's the reverse. The counties, since they have power and authority and policymaking ability, they are the ones who are in the driver's seat to bring the feds in, and they do have to come in and deal with the county at an equal level in policymaking.
Well,
yeah,
let's let some
just,
of these guys comment on.
Let me just jump in real quick. For those who want to know, Fred Kelly Grant's website is www.trademarkamerica.org, and he's going to be in Northern California this week actually giving a free presentation on coordination. So if anybody's in California and wants to know more, just contact me, and I'll get you the information.
And he lives in Idaho. So
yeah, he lives in Nampa, Idaho, which is kind of like a suburb of Boise.
Yes.
Close by Boise.
I'm glad that everybody here listening to this program has a chance to hear about this, because coordination is beginning to catch hold. It's been there all along. The federal government uses it all the time interdepartmentally to coordinate between departments. But the capability has been there, but the local governments have not been aware of it and have not utilized it.
Clarice, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Where do they get their constitutional authority to do that?
It is a federal statute. It is a federal ruling.
I'm asking about constitutional authority. I'm not asking about a statute. I'm not asking about something the feds have put in place. I'm asking about constitution.
It's federal and state statutes require administrative agencies to work coordinately with local government, to coordinate with local government in developing, and it says federal and state statutes. And I'm just reading something here. It's the National Environment. Let's see if I can find that.
Clarice, my point is that they bring forth these statutes, but in fact they don't have any. They were never delegated that authority in the Constitution. They're exercising authority that they don't even have, and they just make up the rules however they want to make them up, and it's up to the people to stop them. We need to get back to our guest. Clarice, thank you very much for calling in.
Yes.
You've contributed well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me just add a couple things about that coordination process from my perspective. Because you're in there before they actually do the planning or do the EIS, in my experience doing for San Juan County, the county can request all the data that the government is using to make these decisions before they actually make the decision. Okay? So in other words, you can request, if you know how to do all this right, and unfortunately, this part of the reason counties don't do this, this costs lots of money because you've got to have lawyers in there, and you have to hire people like me or experts if it's a sage grouse question, whatever it is. You know, if you don't agree with the count, with the data the feds have, you need to collect your own data. The other thing is the feds can pretty much do what they want in the end of it. It's like in the case I did for San Juan County. We presented all the data. The federal government ignored it, but then you've built your case for the lawsuit. But the lady's totally right. You do all the coordination and stuff before you ever do a lawsuit, but if you do it right, you're basically building the case for a possible lawsuit all the time because you know where the holes are in their data. Because if you ask the agency for their data and they don't present you any data because they haven't got anything because they're just making all this stuff up as they go, like with the wolves from the start, well, then that gives you a whole lot better case if you ever just have to take them to court down the road on it. But again, you know, you need to talk to your lawyers about this. I mean, you know, I have the perspective as being an expert who's worked for, you know, counties on specific issues, not the whole general coordination strategy.
Okay. Anybody else want to add anything else on ideas for solutions and things to do beyond what we've talked about already?
Hi, this is Steve. I feel we need to get change with Barry, get him out, get a conservative Senate, and Dr. Kay's made some very definitive recommendations with the ESA. We're going to have to revamp the ESA immediately before we can do, because as Dr. Kay mentioned, the distinct population segment, the DPS and the ESA is what's getting us in trouble. As we know, wolves are not even close to being endangered. So going to take a federal change.
And I think it's a multifaceted solution, by the way. I think changing affecting public opinion is part of this. And one of my themes is that urban America has got to get on board because, you know, I know you don't live in the rural areas, but the reality is it is the backbone of our nation. And we have to really be concerned because we've been blessed in natural resources. We've been blessed in the people that are stewards of our land for so long. We take them for granted. We can't take them for granted anymore because there is a war, and this war is going to determine the outcome. And if we lose this, if we start to import our food and all this kind of stuff and energy increasingly and our wood and so forth from China and India, what else, forget our sovereignty, forget our security. I mean, we've just become beholden, and this seems to be the path that we're going to be on. So I encourage everybody to get on board this issue. I would like to, before we, maybe now is a good time, interrupt this just briefly, if we could go around. Bob, if somebody wants to get hold of you, how would they do that? And you go ahead and feel free to give out your website address, too, if you like.
Okay, well, it's feeding time here at the farm, but there might be a little background noise, but they can get a hold of me, bitterrootbob@gmail.com. My phone is 406-363-8322. The website is rurallibertyorg. I have several websites. I also have vlistwolves.org and also have explorethebitterroot.com.
And Dr. K, if somebody wanted to get hold of you or if you have a website, feel free to listen.
No, I don't have a website because I try to stay out of this political stuff. I would say get a hold of Steve Alder. Look at their website on there because he has all these publications that I've written, and I forget how many there are. There's at least, what, you've got 15 or 20 of the things that I've written on wolves and predation.
Oh, a lot more than that. More like 70 or 80.
Yeah, on his website. Because wolves are just a small part of what I do. I'm very interested in long-term ecosystem states and processes. I've analyzed all these first-person historical accounts. I can tell you, every time Lewis and Clark saw anything for all 863 days of the expedition, I published papers on this. I also do fire frequency stuff and all sorts of other things, too. Wolves are just a small part of what I'm interested in. And, again, I'm not paid for this. I just do this because I have this academic interest in predation and stuff. So I'd say, you know, get a hold of Steve on it, look at his website and stuff on it. Talk to Steve, send him an email, and he'll probably forward it on to me. Because I try to stay out of the political process, and I just do the science. So if you have a technical science question, you know, get it to Steve. And if he can't answer it by directing you to his website, then he'll get it to me.
Okay, Steve, so go ahead, whatever contact information you'd like to give out.
Okay, steve@idahoforwildlife.com. And our website's Idaho for Wildlife. Phone number 208-798-0545.
Okay, very good. All right, and so we have about 15 minutes left. Is that right, Terry?
About 14.
14 minutes or so. So are there any additional things you'd like to bring up, Terry? Yeah, Terry?
I'm sorry? You talking about
me? Are there any additional topics you'd like to bring up?
Well, you know, I don't want to go to a place that our guests are not particularly comfortable with. That I think there's a bigger picture and some things that really need to happen, and I'm even reluctant to ask Red to talk about it because he'll take up the rest of the 14 minutes pretty easily just talking about the real solutions to this stuff. I think you've got to get off the feds playing turf. This is not their turf. The turf belongs to the state and to the county, and it's the people that need to put a stop to this, and their sheriffs, their representative. So, I mean, I think you guys need to talk about what you want to talk about, because if we get off onto that, we'll be another hour, and we don't have another hour. So,
yeah, I'd like to say something here, Terry.
Right ahead, Red.
I've found this very interesting tonight, and I don't know how many of these participants tonight have heard of the 3S, the triple S bumper stickers. There's a publication comes out of Billings, Montana, Western Ag Reporter. It's probably, if it's not the most read, it's very close to being the most read agricultural paper in the country. And they have an editor, a lady that is quite an activist, and she started selling these bumper stickers, the triple S, shoot, shovel, and shut up. And the last I heard, and I know it's way more because I haven't heard for a while, but they had put out over 10,000 of these. So while we're carrying on this program tonight, I can assure you that American ingenuity is very, very active and it's working. I'm communicating with ranchers and such in Montana on almost a daily basis. And I still have interests in Montana, and that's where my heart is, I guess. The people are having to take this on and take care of themselves. The state isn't going to take care of them. The federals aren't going to take care of them. The federals are the problem. It isn't just wolves coming from the federal end. How about the income tax and a few other things that the politicians have come up to make life miserable for us? And so I think Jim Beers would probably remember a situation we had in Montana about 20 years ago. A rancher up in the northwest part of Montana on the east slope of the Continental Divide there. He was eating breakfast, and he looked out, and there was a grizzly bear within a close proximity to his homestead there. And so he dashed out, got in his pickup, and chased the bear and cross country. And he pushed that bear until his heel smoked, and he was he had a pistol, and of course he wasn't too accurate, but after about a mile or two of chase, why, the bear dropped dead. Now, the fellow was very proud of himself, and he talked too much, and the feds came in, of course, and cited him for a felony, and he had to go to federal trial in Great Falls, Montana. This is about 20 years ago, early 90s. And the jury heard the evidence, and the attorney said it was a self-defense thing, and everybody knew that was a joke. And but the jury came out in a short time and said not guilty. And this is what we've got to see. We've got to see an education process with the American people about the power that each and every one of us have if we have enough smarts to know how to use it. Our local paper here in Longview, Washington, where I'm at right now, yesterday reprinted an editorial from the Baltimore Sun newspaper back east in Maryland, and they were advising people to say not guilty in these little petty marijuana cases. They're filling our prisons with people and that have not violated any great laws or anything else. And this is a major newspaper telling the people what I have been telling the people for over 35 years in the state of Montana and across the nation. That's what I wrote about in my books that I've written. And so it's catching on, because the pressure coming from the political mess that we've got in Washington, D.C., and in our state capitals and even our county courthouses, the political pressure put on the American people has caused the American people to readjust their thinking, recognize that they have been brain damaged in an education system, and this type of thing, and they're going to make some major changes. It's going to come from the grassroots. That's what Tea Party was all about, and you're going to see a lot more of that kind of thing. And, of course, I personally believe that the federal government is going to be wiped out in the not-too-distant future. In fact, what it'll be is they will self-destruct. I see where Warren Buffett has decided to support that constitutional amendment that has been on the Internet for a long time. I have said for years that there shouldn't be any federal pensions. There should be Social Security for them, just like the rest of us out here. But they gave themselves. They gave themselves all these goodies out of our pockets. And I'll tell you, we're beginning to feel it, and we're beginning to stir, and we the people are going to make some major, major changes. And so up in Montana, a wolf right now, he has to be pretty careful, because there's people watching for him, and they'll shoot and shovel and shut up. And so it's coming, and you just as well plan on it. And all the talking and everything that we do isn't going to make that much difference. The ingenuity, the inventiveness and creativity of the American people when it is stimulated as it is right now, it makes a big difference. And I see we've only got about 5 minutes left, so I'll go back to Terry. It's been very interesting. Good to hear that there's people out there trying to make a difference.
Thank you, Red. Kurt, you got five to finish her up here, bud.
Oh, thank you, Terry. And I want to continue to thank you and Dr. Kate and Red Beckman for, you know, really allowing your show to be used to, you know, support this Defend Rural America project. And week after week, I think just continuing to peel back the layers of this story, and, you know, hopefully the listening audience continues to dial in week after week and listen, because everything that we're bringing is relevant, it's real, it's by the people who are engaged in this stuff, and it's important. Anybody that has not yet done so should try it out. Go to the defendruralamerica.com website. It's been really newly redesigned, new content. There's a tab on wolves on there that is very interesting and informative. So people should do that. I'd like to go around the table, perhaps, and give everybody at least a chance to say one minute worth of closing statements. Bob, is there any last words you'd like to say?
Sure. In that light, rurallibertycom.org, on the Take Action tab, you can go in and send letters to, it's just a couple clicks. You send a letter to your representatives at the federal level to support the Government Litigation Savings Act. And also, there's one there to support the hearings that are ongoing through February concerning the Endangered Species Act and how it's destroying jobs. And those are ongoing in the Natural Resource Committee. The other thing that is, and Steve might know a little bit about this real quick, is that the Idaho Conservation League is actively trying to do a giant land grab under the guise of protecting woodland caribou. This is in the Selkirk Mountains behind the Schweitzer Mountain Resort. They are saying that human traffic and logging, which there is no logging up there anymore, are causing the demise of the woodland caribou. Of course, they don't even take into consideration the wolves that they just threw in there. But this is nothing more than trying to shut down more land. It's a giant land grab. You know, they basically want to, you know, force it into wilderness area again. So
I'm going to jump in. I want to make sure everybody has at least a minute here. Dr. K, would you like to say any closing comments?
Yeah, we're sort of here sitting here laughing to myself about that woodland caribou stuff. I mean, the wolves are in the process of wiping out woodland and mountain caribou across the length and breadth of Canada, okay? Tom Berger, who's written papers on this type of stuff, has written a whole book on it and everything else. It's all predation that's taking them out. All the other stuff is smoke and mirrors on that stuff. So that's all I have to say about that. There's all sorts of data and stuff that they're totally ignoring. The reason woodland caribou are in the toilet and going down to extinction has to do with predation, both in the mountain lions and that particular herd you're talking about, and then wolves across the length and breadth of Canada.
Okay, and Steve, do you have any last thoughts?
Yeah, just recommend, we build our website basically for education. So go to our website, idahowildlife.com, look under wolf data, study that. Everything that we're talking about is there. Tom Berger emailed me today. He's just frustrated because of what's going on with caribou. They're going to extinction. We're lobbying like crazy with the state legislators. We're active. We're just really involved. We need everybody educated. We need to work them on county, local, city, state, federal levels. People have got to find out what's going on. And that's our biggest niche is education.
Okay, and then with the final minute or two, what I'd like to be able to say is thank Bob Sherman, because it was really Bob that managed to bring on Dr. K and Keith and Steve, and I greatly appreciate that fact. So, Bob, why don't you, I kind of cut you off there, why don't you go ahead and take the last minute or two that we have left?
That's fine. I mean, I was pretty much done anyway, but if somebody wanted to do something positive, they could contact, if you live in Idaho, especially contact your state legislators there and, you know, try to stop that land grab by the Idaho Conservation League.
Well, but, not only the caribou, but the grizzly bear, is they're using that. That's the most, Bonner's County is the most trampled on county in the whole United States because of the grizzly and the wolf and the caribou.
Yep. And, you know, like I said, the take action, that's one thing that these environmental groups do. They send out these action alerts, and that's why we put these on realliberty.org. It's a quick way and an easy way for people to get involved and you know, start getting some of our voices in front of Congress.
Welcome. I want to thank everybody for showing up tonight and giving us your professional expertise, and really appreciate what all of you had to say. And we will be back next week with Walls in Our Minds. Thanks, Kurt. Thanks, Red. Kate.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Terry, and thanks.
And darling, darling, won't you stand by me? If the sky look upon me, should tumble and fall, fall of the mountain, may crumble to the sea. I won't cry, I won't cry. No, 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 I won't. No tears, just as long as you stand by me. I'm the only darling. I said I need somebody, and need just a little helping hand. Need someone to come pick me up and let me stand by me. Come on, come on.
Thank you.